Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage. This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week we'll be looking at the changing faces in the Criminal Justice Division, and we'll find out what the business community has to say to the Lieutenant Governor. A powerful state senator criticizes the press. We'll hear about that and about a state worker who organizes community gardens across New York. This and much more, it's all coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. The head of the criminal justice apparatus in New York State, Lawrence T. Curlander, presented his resignation last week to Governor Cuomo. Curlander, known by some as the czar of criminal justice, decided to leave state government to become a vice president of corporate affairs for American Express. I asked him what his toughest decision was in his position as criminal justice director.
Well, there are two things that come to mind immediately. First, of course, was the Ossining prison riot. I don't think anything one ever does in this life can compare to having to deal with that kind of a situation. And that was 8 days into an administration when we were all brand new. That was very tough. Thank God it came out all right.
What was the piece of advice you learned from that, that you would leave to others during a prison riot?
There are a couple, I think. One is that overcrowded jails and prisons are a prescription for disaster. And the second thing is that you've got to pay very, very close attention to early warning signals and signs in the prison system.
When you saw this Cuban riot coming down, were you making an analogy between what you went through at Ossining and what they were going through there?
No, I think that there are a lot of similar characteristics in prison riots, but this one was the Mariel Cuban riots were a bit different in that they were based on a particular event that took place, the announcement by the Department of Justice that it was going to take certain actions against the Mariels, and that triggered an immediate response. And in that sense, it was quite different than what happened at Ossining.
And if you compared Ossining with Attica earlier, which ended up in disaster, as opposed to Ossining, which ended up very well, what would you say there?
Well, I think that I don't want to throw stones at the people who handled Attica. And if you weren't there and you weren't on the scene, despite all you may have read about it, you don't have a really true flavor of you know, the precipitating causes and the judgments that were made, and I don't want to second guess. But I'll tell you something, Mario Cuomo really proved his leadership once and for all in how he handled Ossining. The judgments that he made, his leadership, his presence there throughout the ordeal, managing this crisis, really demonstrated that there's a way you can get out of a difficult situation.
In other words, you negotiate rather than shoot from the hip?
Well, he did a lot of good things. He was very tough. He did not accede to the demands. Some of the more fundamental demands. He handled it in a very, very tough, but, firm and fair manner. And that's been the hallmark of his governorship.
Now, let's move from prisons to police in general. Do you find in looking over the state of policing in New York State that things have either deteriorated or strengthened in your tenure?
Oh, I think that where our police forces are becoming much more professional than they've been in the past. I think that the emerging issue in policing is clearly going to be accreditation. Under the governor's leadership, again, we will be the first state in the nation to have police accreditation. You know, there's a national accreditation board. It's a voluntary kind of thing. It's privately funded and so on. It does good things. But we have some unique characteristics in New York. And I'll tell you, other states know that New York has jumped in and to take the lead, to professionalize totally their police forces, large and small. And they're already coming to us to see what we're doing and to borrow from our experience. And once again, Mario Cuomo is on the cutting edge of change.
You've stayed by and watched as the governor has been smeared by these mafia allegations, and now that is past us, and some of those accountable have been held accountable. I mean, you're a close friend. You've watched the whole thing happen. Do you have any observations to make about that?
Unfortunately, I do. I mean, the smears were the most vicious kinds of things. There was no foundation, in fact, for them. People just misbehaved in a very fundamental kind of a way.
Knew what they were doing.
In an effort to smear an honorable man. And, you know, the worst kind of a political campaign is a whisper campaign, and that's what this was. And wherever you went, you'd pick it up, and it always came back. I mean, there were common sources, and it's a tragedy that people have to do this kind of thing, that they're mean-spirited, and, you know, political differences are one thing. But to really falsely accuse another individual of wrongdoing or to smear them because they're of a certain ethnic background is the worst kind of politics imaginable.
Larry, you're going on to American Express, obviously to a job that's going to pay more. Are we mistreating our top civil service managers? A guy like you, you now have more training in this area than virtually anyone else. You're a profound expert in criminal justice, and yet we lose you because the governor couldn't begin to pay you what an outside firm does, and you have to think of your family, the rest of it. Are we making a mistake in the way in which we pay our public officials?
I don't think so. I think that I received a very adequate wage here. It's true that I could make more in the private sector. I could have made more before. But I have to tell you that there are things in life that go beyond money, and serving the public is one of them.
Yes, but we couldn't keep you.
No, but I think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that 5 years in a job where you work 7 days a week and you're going 12, 14 hours a day is about all a person should stay. Mm-hmm. I think to have fresh ideas and to have other people who are ready to spring into action is a very healthy thing. I don't view it as a negative. I think that, I could feel myself in certain cases getting stale. You put in that kind of time and that kind of effort, there's a burnout factor. And I don't think people ought to hang around collect huge salaries when they're not really on the cutting edge of change and willing to devote, enormous energy to it.
Lawrence Kurlander, director of the New York State Criminal Justice Division. New York is now the only state in the country with an Office of Community Gardening. It's a fledgling effort to provide state support for community gardens and other open space that is designed, managed, and used by the people who live around it. Maury Small reports.
The four-month-old New York State Office of Community Gardening is part of the State Agriculture and Markets Department, but we're not talking here about some vast new bureaucracy. Coordinator Paul Winkeller is the Office of Community Gardening. He's a former speechwriter for the Carter administration who got interested in community gardening after writing about environmental matters for the Interior Department. Now Winkeller's mission is to help neighborhood groups and local officials across New York set up community open spaces and obtain state money to do it. Winkeller says community gardening has always been part of American life, even before the victory gardens of World War II.
Even back in the late 1800s, when immigrants came and moved to cities with no land, there were community gardens. They're called potato patches. In the 1890s, throughout the country, there were these things called potato patches. And there were called potato patches. I think it was sort of, in a way, it's an ethnic slur, because mm-hmm. it wasn't just Irish people growing potatoes, but it mm-hmm. they were immigrants and they were poor, so they... But historically, these waves of community gardens have up and gone, mostly having to do with the economy or through a war effort, and the gardens disappear, usually when the whatever reason that they came about disappears, like the war ended and food production could be, I mean, all the food didn't have to get sent overseas. But this wave of community gardening seems to have more staying power.
This wave of community gardening began in the early 1970s after a nationwide event called Earth Day focused Americans' concern about the environment. Hundreds of community gardens sprang up, and Wincolor says the practice has grown since then. There are 2,000 different organizations working in community gardening in New York State alone. You might think community gardens would die out in this age of the yuppie, but Wincolor says, in fact, with more and more Americans trying to avoid chemicals in their food and spend more time outdoors, community gardens are a natural. Neighborhoods are also expanding the idea to create playgrounds, fruit orchards, and parks, all designed and coordinated by residents of the community. Wincolor says these projects often give birth to a real community where before there were just strangers who happened to live next to each other.
Vegetable gardening, especially in a public situation with other families and other people, is, especially in denser urban areas, you know, that's some of the only opportunity to meet people unlike yourself. I mean, some amazing things happen in neighborhoods at community gardens. I mean, the community garden becomes almost like a block party. Mm-hmm. And when people get to know each other over their gardens, they then go on to talk about their kids' schools and about their housing and about their services they get from the city governments.
Once a community garden does take root, it often has to fight to stay there. Buildings now stand on many former community garden sites. But Wincolor says New York City community gardeners have won many of their battles against developers, that thanks to support from the city government.
You know, there are community gardeners in Manhattan who are gardening, who are doing whatever they're doing on a vacant lot that might be worth $1 million. And, you know, that's when you get some real, you know, you get some extremely, not just fighting about controlling land, but, you know, what is important in a city. Mm-hmm. Is it important to have open space, or is it as important to grow, to build as many buildings as you can?
Wincolor says there's plenty of state money now available for citizen-managed open space, including some funds from the Environmental Quality Bond Act. He wants neighborhoods and local officials to know the money's there and ask for it.
I got here in July, and I realized that outside of the city, and because there are so many people looking for money for zoning programs in the city, they know where everything is. When I started interacting with groups upstate and in Long Island, they didn't even know Bond Act money was available. And so here again, I feel as a role just in information. Mm-hmm. You know, did you know that New York State Council of the Arts has given away money to, in Troy, for instance, to do an art project in the garden? Well, probably not too many people know that. You know, do you know that there's planning money available to do citywide community space, community open space planning?
The New York Office of Community Gardening has a $42,000 budget to spread the word about state help for community gardening. Next spring, Coordinator Wincolor will oversee 5 workshops around the state with local officials and neighborhood organizations that want to start community gardens, playgrounds, parks, or fruit orchards to brighten their corner of New York State. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Maury Small.
Members of the New York State business community met with Governor Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen to discuss their proposals for the 1988 legislative session. The Lieutenant Governor spoke with Dave Gillette about that meeting.
I joined the governor in meeting with the leaders of the New York business community, represented primarily by the Business Council. I guess they started back with Governor Kerry having a summit each year prior to his budget and state of the state decisions becoming final, in which they talked about the matters that the business community thinks is important to New York.
Now, you'll be dealing with a new character in all this this year, Dan Walsh, probably well known to you from your part of the state.
Yes, Dan Walsh was the Assembly Majority Leader and is a longtime friend of mine. He's an outstanding public servant, and now I think he'll be an outstanding representative of the business community. Ray Schuler really put together the Business Council, combining the Chamber of Commerce and the manufacturing or associated industries of New York State. I think Dan will take this agenda and move it to the next level, and he'll do an outstanding job.
Well, what are the major areas of agreement between the state and its business community?
Well, I think the business community is very pleased about the tax cuts we've been able to enact in New York. They feel that we're on a positive economic track in New York, and that government and business are working together in this state to create a New York advantage to the degree that's probably unusual in any state. So we have government and business working very closely together.
One of the things that you've been particularly involved in is trying to bring high-tech industry into New York State, and we've heard some news this week about the Super Collider project that your office has responded to, but I'd like to talk to you for a moment about it. Supposedly there's a list that New York's not on.
I understand. We talked to the reporter who wrote the story for the Chicago Tribune. What he's reporting is that after the scientists reviewed some but not all of the sites, there were six mainly western states on the list that they were going to send to the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy categorically denies it, and we don't have any more information than this, except to know that of this partial list, we were not on it. So I don't consider it hard information, but to the extent that any list is revealed without New York being on it, obviously I'm disappointed.
Let me get a little cynical with you for a moment. Would it be a political plus or a political minus if indeed New York was finally overlooked for the Super Collider project?
We started out trying to bring this project to New York, and we think it'll be a political plus if we do so. Obviously, we explained right from the beginning that it's a long shot, that we've got many tough competitors, and there's a question whether the Congress will even go forward with the project. And I think our citizens can understand that. So I don't think the political stakes are enormous, but I think it would be more positive if we're selected as one of the finalists than if we're not.
Well, you've obviously seen a lot of controversy. I understand that there's some controversy surrounding some sites in California as well.
Well, we would have to, if it's the Rochester site that's selected on the best qualified list, we would have some controversy there. But that's why we're leaders. We're paid to deal with controversy to some degree and to provide some leadership. Obviously, it would be easier in terms of the local community if we were dealing with the North Country being on the best qualified list.
And obviously, we'll have yet to see another few weeks on that.
Yes, I think we will. It should be sometime in January when we get the final list.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. A top Republican senator this week charged reporter Fred Dicker of the New York Post with illegal trespass. Paul Rosenthal has more.
An influential state senator from Staten Island is demanding an explanation from the New York Post for the actions of one of its reporters. Senator John Markey says Post reporter Frederick Dicker improperly gained access to the senator's Manhattan offices in June. Dicker was doing a story about what he concluded was Markey's waste of taxpayers' money by maintaining the $114,000 a year offices in Manhattan, though the senator rarely used them. In a letter addressed to Post publisher Patrick Purcell, Markey demanded an explanation from the paper about how Dicker got into the offices. In the absence of that, Markey said he expects an apology from the newspaper. If he gets neither, Markey said he intends to proceed in court with a criminal trespass complaint in New York City Criminal Court. Markey is chairman of the Senate's Finance Committee. He was unavailable for comment. Jerry McLaughlin is a spokesman for the senator. I asked him why it has taken so long for the senator to take action.
Senator Markey went before a criminal court judge on this matter and in June, and the judge asked him whether he wanted Mr. Dicker arrested, and Senator Markey said no, that while he thought that this is a serious matter, that he felt that Mr. Dicker was trying apparently for a news story and not anything else. So that's number one. Number two, he obtained appropriate papers that to be served on Mr. Dicker and was not able to serve them because the papers are servable in the New York City area, not up in Albany. And he was not able to determine, nor his office, when Mr. Dicker might be available to be served.
After a certain time, Senator Markey withdrew that request, only to move again now, including the editor of the Post, who is permanently located in New York City. I asked Mr. McLaughlin if Senator Markey is filing suit because of Mr. Dicker's actions or because the story Dicker obtained was damaging to the senator.
Well, I think that anyone, the senator, if he were here, would say that no one's above the law, and that if someone breaks, enters unlawfully into your home or your office, you have a right to do something about it. No one, reporters, legislators, public relations people, or radio news people have a right to enter unlawfully into someone's premises. So that's really what it's all about. Senator Markey's been in business here a long time and enjoys a good reputation, and it's buffeted as all people in public life are periodically. But no, that's he's not interested in any retribution. He just wants an explanation as to why Mr. Dicker was in the office.
Jerry McLaughlin, spokesman for Senator John Markey. So I then asked Fred Dicker why he was in Senator Markey's office.
Well, frankly, I'd like to know why Senator Markey isn't spending his time trying to figure out why the legislature up here has as much corruption in it as legislators and prosecutors, I think, now agree that it has, and why he's wasting his time going, and the public's time, going after a journalist who did a story which revealed that while he was keeping warehoused a whole suite of state-paid offices in New York City, the Senate Republicans, a little bit uptown in Midtown, we're spending $116,000 a year of the taxpayers' money renting a suite of offices for Senate Majority Warren Anderson, who was only in New York City four or five times all of this year. I think the guy, increasingly as he gets older, is known as sort of a clownish character in Albany, and this is just one illustration of it.
I asked Mr. Dicker if Senator Markey will get his apology and explanation. Fred Dicker explained it all for us.
Well, he's certainly not going to get an apology. I was simply doing my job by way of explanation. I had come to realize that there was this suite of offices that had been assigned to Markey, public offices, that had gone literally years unused. In fact, when I got into the office, I found several letters there which had postmarks on them 2 years or older, which were just laying there unopened. This is official Senate correspondence to Senator Markey, and he didn't even open his own letters. I entered that office suite in what I considered to be a perfectly legal way. I certainly didn't jimmy the door or break in. I spoke to people in neighboring offices who told me that the office was never open, that it was a shame because they themselves had such, they claimed, small offices themselves that they could use the extra space. And there was a great deal of public interest, I'd say, in why this was being done. I was doing nothing other than what a good reporter would do. And here's John Markey trying to, I think, chill the activities of all investigative reporters who, after all, are the ones who exposed the scandals of the legislature this year. It didn't come from the lawmakers themselves, that's for sure.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
Investigations into the WedTech scandal hit a new turn this week with the testimony of Vito Castellano, the former head of the New York National Guard. Our own Brenda McMahon reports.
The WedTech scandal began to unravel when it was discovered that several top state representatives and employees were wrapped in a web of bribery. The latest addition to the WedTech testimony came from Major General Vito Castellano, former head of the New York National Guard. Castellano has been linked to the developing scandal surrounding the WedTech Corporation, this week admitting that he took more than $50,000 in bribes from former state militia Major General Bernard Ehrlich. Ehrlich, also accused in the scandal, was WedTech's director and counsel at the time. Castellano also admitted that he committed bigamy and accepted an automobile from Penthouse magazine. Castellano, who was a Kerry administration appointee, resigned from his $75,000 job as head of the New York State National Guard in January 86, following a controversy surrounding his handling of Hurricane Gloria in 1985. Since his resignation, Governor Cuomo appointed a new head of the National Guard, Major General Lawrence Flynn. Flynn had to replace Castellano in the wake of criticism and the unfolding corruption scandal, but his spokesman, Major Peter Cachera, says Castellano's activities didn't hurt the reputation of the National Guard.
Well, I think that we in the Guard largely view this as actions by the former head of this agency that were based on his own decisions and his own ethical and moral judgments, and as such have no connection with the organization he headed or the 20,000 plus very dedicated men and women that make up the National Guard and the New York State Militia.
But Cachera says Flynn set up safeguards against corruption by instituting a corruption hotline number.
We have implemented in the National Guard since General Castellano left the agency a toll-free fraud, waste, abuse, and hotline. The number is posted in every one of our armories and air bases and installations around the state. In addition, General Lawrence Flynn, who is the head of the agency now, has paid a great deal of attention to it in the development of a criminal investigations directorate, which acts expeditiously on any of the reports that are turned up by the hotline.
Cachera says the hotline number, which was also printed in the division's newsletter, received some 60 to 70 calls from concerned workers. But in all this, Cachera stresses that the Castellano administration is one of the past, and Major General Flynn is not letting that tarnished image hurt the National Guard. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brenda McMahon.
And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show was produced by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Paul Rosenthal, Maurice Small, and David Gillette. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in again next week for what's happening in and around the Empire State. Until then, I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.